You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 5th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. This is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead...
I believe that the Israeli society needs to renew its contract with its leadership, and I think the only way to do it and still maintaining the national effort in fighting Hamas and terrorist group and other security challenges is by having an agreed election date.
Netanyahu's main rival, War Cabinet member Benny Gantz, calls for an early election. We'll examine the likelihood of that happening. An anti-army resistance alliance in Myanmar attacks several military targets in a significant blow to the junta. We'll get up to speed in what's happened since the coup in 2021 and what might lie ahead. The cake is eaten, the candles are blown out. After NATO's 75th birthday celebrations, we'll ask just what was achieved. We'll rustle through the day's front pages, have a roundup of urbanism news, as well as pay tribute to the great Italian designer, artist and architect Gaetano Pesce. And as it's Friday, we'll take a wry look back at the last 7 days.
We learned that for the first time since Hannibal and his Carthaginian legions bore down upon Rome from over the Alps in 218 BC, Europe is threatened with invasion by elephants.
That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. In a call with Benjamin Netanyahu, US President Joe Biden threatened to condition support for Israel's offensive in Gaza on it taking concrete steps to protect aid workers and civilians. Support is building among African and Caribbean nations for the creation of an international tribunal on atrocities dating to the transatlantic slave trade. And torrential rains pummeled Australia's southeast today, dumping almost a month's worth of rainfall on Sydney and triggering flood warnings. Do stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, on Saturday, several thousand people in Israel demonstrated on the streets demanding the removal of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Now their call has been supported by Netanyahu's main rival and member of the War Cabinet, Benny Gantz. The minister says there should be a snap parliamentary election in September. Well, I'm joined now on the line by Abir Ayoub, who is a Palestinian journalist based in Istanbul. Abir, many thanks for coming back on the show. I wonder what's driving Gantz. I mean, was he triggered by the increasing international pressure, most recently over the death of humanitarian aid workers, or have these cracks always existed within the War Cabinet?
Well, it has been more than 5 months since the war began, and Israel, until the moment, is failing to achieve the goals that Benjamin Netanyahu announced at the beginning of the war to achieve, especially getting the hostages back to their homes. Now we are talking about 134 hostages who are still in Gaza, and the Israeli team, from Gantz's perspective, is not doing what it should be doing to bring them back. Gantz, of course, would use such a golden chance to show his abilities or to show his readiness to take over, to bring the people back, especially with the thousands of Israelis going out to the streets demanding their children to be back.
And how has this demand to resign been received by Netanyahu and his Likud party?
Netanyahu disapproved the demand, and this is understood. He said that he's doing what he should be doing to bring the Israelis back. But as I said, after 5 months, and we are approaching the sixth, and the hostages are still in Gaza, and as the families are making a huge pressure on Bibi's government to bring the hostages back. Indeed, the families don't care about the strategies Netanyahu is doing. What they care about is that they want their children back. And time is passing. Some hostages were killed in the past. So it's very understood why they are making this pressure.
So elections aren't due until 2026. What would need to happen administratively for a snap poll to be held?
I don't think it's easy to predict what's going to happen because the differences and conflicts between Gantz, Bibi and other Israeli parties has been on the surface since the war began because now we are hearing about pressure also from the United States on Bibi's government. The whole situation is unpredictable. It's new. It's a long-term war. And the goals Netanyahu announced are not being achieved. So it's understood why everyone is trying to show or to propose an end to the war and a solution. I don't think this is a perfect timing for elections to happen, but I expect the differences to stay in the way.
Right, but early elections require the agreement of the majority of deputies or at least 61 elected officials. Is the Knesset likely to agree to that? Would it go through?
I don't think so, because the priority now is to bring the hostages back and to end the war and to achieve the goals. And having elections at this time would be an additional hassle to Israelis that they don't really need.
So the special legal status of ultra-Orthodox Jews came to an end on Monday. That was after a Supreme Court decision that the group wouldn't benefit from government subsidies and exemption from military service any longer. And of course, that's mandatory for most other Jewish Israelis. Do you think that the support of ultra-Orthodox Jews is fading away? Is that further eroding support for Netanyahu?
Yes, I do. And I think that the more time is passing without bringing hostages back, without destroying Hamas, without achieving any of the goals, Bibi will still receive more criticism from people who supported him before and pressure from local and international sides.
So who's in line to replace Netanyahu should this happen?
Gantz is showing his willingness to take over. But what I'm convinced of that after all this time of the war and the goals that are not being achieved, I believe that Netanyahu is in a real test regarding his popularity in the street.
But I mean, if Gantz, for instance, were to take over, or indeed anybody who's involved at the moment, is there anybody who's untarnished by the war with Gaza? Anyone who wouldn't be viewed as complicit in the deaths of innocent civilians and the seeming inability to bring the hostages home?
Not really, because even the officials in the war cabinet since the war began, they have statements that explicitly supported the killings in Gaza, and no one was really doing a different statement. So I believe what would be different, it would be different to the Israelis, not to the Palestinians in Gaza, who now we have 32,000 killed until now, and we have 7-8 workers killed, and the situation is not getting any better.
And finally, if Netanyahu goes, what then happens to him regarding his corruption charges and all his legal problems?
I believe, as analysts say, that the end of the war would indeed be the end of Netanyahu's rule to Israel. Why? Because the whole thing of October the 7th happened because of some security failures, according to analysts, and the performance of him during these 6 months was not satisfying to Israelis. So indeed, the end of the war would mean that he might have serious changes in his situation as a prime minister.
Abir, thank you very much indeed. That's Abir Ayoub there, and this is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's 8:11 in Zurich, 7:11 here in London. And now to Myanmar. The country is embroiled in a civil war between the military and an alliance of anti-junta groups called the National Unity Government, which represents the elected civilian government previously led by Aung San Suu Kyi, deposed in a 2021 coup. The group's armed affiliate, the People's Defence Force, or PDF, has announced it carried out coordinated drone attacks on two military installations in the capital, Naypyidaw. If this is confirmed, it could be the biggest test of the military's hold on power since taking control of the former British colony back in 1962. Well, I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Ronan Lee, an academic and the author of Myanmar's Rohingya Genocide, Identity, History and Hate Speech. Ronan, it's lovely to have you back in the studio. I wonder if you could tell us what's been happening in the country since the coup 3 years ago.
Well, the coup's deeply unpopular. I mean, there was an election held in Myanmar in late 2020 that overwhelmingly returned the administration of Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy government. The people have rejected the military's proxy party at every opportunity they've been given over the last 20 years to do that. It's very clear the people of Myanmar do not want the military having control over them. In response to that election, when the Myanmar military, fearing, I think, that their power was going to be further curtailed because of the democratic mandate that Aung San Suu Kyi's party had received, launched a coup in February of 2021, again, deeply unpopular. Immediately, the public of Myanmar protested the coup. There were very large peaceful protests throughout the country. The military responded with lethal force, shooting peaceful protesters. And very quickly, things descended into the sort of civil war context that we see today. It took the opposition, though, some time to reorganize. The coup involved the arrest of virtually every elected democratic politician in the country. Aung San Suu Kyi has been virtually incommunicado since February of 2021. But by September of 2021, the government in exile, the National Unity Government, announced that it would launch what they called a defensive war against the Myanmar military. And that's involved these People's Defence Force groups. They've taken some time to arm themselves, to also link up with the armed wings of ethnic and religious minority groups within the country that have been fighting the Myanmar military virtually since independence in 1948. And what we're now seeing in recent times is the fruits of their labour over the last 2 or 2.5 years.
Mm. Now, there was a definite turn in favour of the National Unity Government in October. What happened then?
Well, three groups, the Brotherhood Alliance, as they style themselves, took on the Myanmar military within Shan State. This is on the frontier with China. They launched a campaign in late October, October 27. They call it the 1027 campaign, and very quickly overran around 200 Myanmar military locations. I mean, this was a huge defeat for the Myanmar military, a big reversal in terms of the control of territory within Shan State. It prompted the person they say is the president of the country to state in state media that there was a fear that the country was going to be almost broken up. I mean, this is incredibly symbolic for the Myanmar military. It regards its core duty to be the non-disintegration of the Union of Myanmar. So a statement by a senior figure that the country was at risk of being broken up is hugely significant, hugely embarrassing for the Myanmar military. Last week was Armed Forces Day. That's normally a day in Naypyidaw, the capital, the military garrison capital, where there would be parades, military parades. They had to hold those at night because they cannot be certain when opposition groups, the people endorsed by the people, will launch attacks upon them. And the message to the Myanmar military is that from the people of Myanmar, we don't want you in power, and we can get at you wherever you are.
And so what's the details of this latest attack?
Well, drone strikes across Naypyidaw. I mean, Naypyidaw is a planned city. It's unusual within Myanmar. It's an entirely planned city. It was basically built by the Myanmar military to be a garrison capital, to be in the context of fears of external involvement in the country. It's the capital that you create if you're worried that you might get invaded, or you're worried that peacekeepers from the UN might come to your country to remove you from power. So I think it's designed not to be easy to attack, but it was attacked. And it was attacked by drones, 24 drones. They landed at an Air Force base. They landed at facilities known to be frequented and used by the senior general, the coup leader, Min Aung Hlaing. And there's different reports on what occurred. The National Unity Government certainly has said, well, we regard this as a success. The military, of course, pretends that its opposition has no success, but the point here is that this is the National Unity Government making very clear that they are bringing the fight to the heart of the Myanmar military's apparatus. It's quite significant, I think.
Mm. How do you see the situation unfolding?
Well. All the fundamentals have been running against the Myanmar military, against the junta, for quite some time now. I mean, that was made abundantly clear in October of last year. It's been made abundantly clear this week. It was clear from the actions of the military. They're scared to even have a parade in the garrison capital on Armed Forces Day during the day, because they know that National Unity Government forces can get at them. This is pretty significant, and it means that I think these fundamentals are going to continue to run against the Myanmar military. I mean, it's taken some time for the People's Defence Force groups to coordinate their activities, to arm themselves. It's taken time for them to be able to coordinate with ethnic and religious minority armed groups, but these things are happening now. What we've seen in the past is that the Myanmar military, it's got lots of troops, but it itself was fearful that there'd be an internal coup. It's scared of losing power. So it doesn't have that many troops that are well-trained. It's tended to move its well-trained, battle-hardened troops around the country from one crisis to another. Well, now they're stretched. They're stretched across the country, and they're starting to lose. And this is new for them. This is not something they've faced before. And it's having a significant effect on them. And I hope that what we're seeing now is the beginning of the end.
So the former ousted civilian leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, she's now 78. She's still in state custody. We know that, of course, she won the Nobel Peace Prize, but she's now been criticised for defending her country against allegations of genocide at the UN, at the ICJ. And that came after widespread claims that Myanmar had committed atrocities against Muslim Rohingya while her government was in power. I know you've written extensively on this. Is Aung San Suu Kyi too tarnished to return to power should the junta be defeated?
I think Myanmar's long-term future, its long-term democratic future, won't involve Aung San Suu Kyi. In the short term, I think certainly she will be, if the coup can be defeated, she will immediately emerge as the obvious choice of the National Unity Government. I mean, she's the person they claim to be their leader. It's who they say will be in charge if they can take power. But I think long term, there's now an understanding within Myanmar that the future of Myanmar is about the next generation and has to move towards that. The fact that she's been incommunicado for some years now has meant that the political reorganisation that democratic forces within Myanmar haven't been able to do over the last 20 years has had to happen over the last 3 years. People's Defence Force groups, these have not been directed by Aung San Suu Kyi. She was adamantly opposed to violent action against the Myanmar military. She was the person who advocated democracy by peaceful means only. Non-violent approach is her signature policy. But that's not what's going to win the battle against the junta. And that's a fundamental shift in the way the democratic forces within Myanmar see themselves. And I think it means there has to be a fundamental shift in the long-term leadership, and there will be.
Dr. Ronan Lee, thank you very much indeed. Now, still to come on the programme.
When design is able to express contents that are not only functional, but is also religious content or political or philosophical or what, then in that moment design becomes an art.
We pay tribute to the artist, designer and architect Caetano Pesce, who's died at the age of 84. This is The Globalist. It is 7:21 here in London, and I'm Georgina Godwin. This is The Globalist, and we're continuing with today's newspapers. Joining me in the studio is political journalist and Monocle Radio regular, Vincent McAvinny. Good morning to you, Vinny.
Good morning.
Let us talk about the story we're reporting in our headlines, and of course it is across the world's papers today, and that is Joe Biden's call with Netanyahu.
Yes, it seems President Joe Biden has finally had enough of Bibi Netanyahu's antics somewhat. He has threatened in a call to condition future support for Israel on how it addresses his concerns about civilian casualties and the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, prompting Israel to commit to more food and other supplies into the enclaves, with some checkpoints opening up overnight. Now, this comes, of course, after several workers for the charity World Central Kitchen were killed, they say, sort of very recklessly and carelessly by IDF forces in Gaza earlier this week. That has led to fresh outcry from people both in the United States and around the world about how Israel is conducting its affairs, questions over its rules of engagement. And this also comes after yesterday, some 600 legal experts here in the UK, including three former Supreme Court justices, warned that Britain needs to stop selling arms to Israel because there is a genuine now risk of genocide in Gaza.
And of course, during this call, it was made absolutely clear of the price if Israel does not play ball on this. They said if we don't see the changes that we need to see, there will be changes in policy.
Yes, and this is you know, something that President Biden, he's got the sort of domestic audience to deal with, but also world audience, as well as the bilateral relationship with Israel. But this is incredibly strong. The US gives billions of dollars in aid to Israel. It has always championed it as a you know, a democracy in the Middle East. Strong links, of course, between Jewish people in America and Jewish people in Israel. It doesn't seem that a military aid at the moment will be affected, but other aid could be. What is interesting for President Biden, which has somewhat taken him and sort of the older parts of the Democratic establishment aback, is the disconnect or the change in views on this conflict, particularly with younger generations of Democrats. They're very worried that in the election, this could cost them votes in certain key states, not just amongst Muslim voters, but amongst younger people who are primarily getting their news from TikTok, who are seeing it from a very different lens, and who have also sort of grown up not in the way that Joe Biden did, where sort of Israel was this kind of shining light, this beacon in the Middle East, this project that they all sort of thought was a good idea, but they are very critical of Israel because of things like the settlers breaking international law, and so there is that home concern. So perhaps now he's feeling, looking at the polls, he needs to start getting tougher on Bibi Netanyahu because he might not be around for much longer and it's time to move.
And it's that group, it's that younger demographic, in fact, that is driving this decision by McDonald's to buy back their franchise in Israel. Tell us more on that.
Fascinating story here about a company like McDonald's. Now, if you don't know this, McDonald's basically doesn't control its restaurants. It operates them as a franchise model. So people come in and they can set up hundreds of restaurants. This is the case in Israel and many countries around the world. And this is where some 225 outlets that are employing some 5,000 people are going to be bought back by McDonald's from the franchisee in the country. And this is because it has had a global impact on the McDonald's brand and the profits it's been making, because those restaurants in Israel have been offering at times during the last few months free meals to IDF soldiers in a way of supporting them. That has obviously gone down badly in other territories, and they've seen huge declines in sales in Muslim countries, particularly in the Middle East. But they've also seen declines in sales here in Europe in certain countries like France, like in Ireland. And so these big markets that they are losing out in means that they need to get a better grip of, they think, the Israeli branch of the restaurant. So they didn't say they're not going to abandon Israel, that they're going to continue to operate there, but they are going to take direct control of these. It's an issue that they've faced around the world with this model, particularly here in the UK. There's been an ongoing scandal about sexual harassment in its restaurants. And it tries to say, you know, we don't run these, it's the franchisees. But when everyone sees the golden arches over a restaurant, they think it's ran by McDonald's.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's continue to talk about sexual scandals. And if we needed any more proof at how completely tawdry our Conservative government is, then this story in the Times certainly proves it. Tell us about this honey trap sex scandal.
Yeah, this story sounded pretty bad yesterday when it first emerged, that a number of MPs and journalists had been targeted by an individual in a honey trap scandal. That is where you sort of, you know, this person messaged them. They claimed that they'd met previously at an event and they tried to sort of engage them in sort of flirty banter, sent them explicit content. Some replied. But it then got even worse when it turned out that Will Ragg, who is a sort of, he's quite young, he's only sort of 36, 37, but he's sort of a senior backbencher. He's on the 1922 committee. He played a big role in getting rid of Boris Johnson, that he apparently had sort of talk to this person, who there are suspicions could be a foreign agent from the likes of Russia or China. It's unclear at the moment who this individual is, or if they're sort of just a domestic scammer of some kind. That he exchanged texts and explicit images with this person. Then this person managed to blackmail him in order to get the names and he gave him a list of names of people's numbers that he wanted, including other MPs, ministers, journalists. And then this person then systematically contacted these people and played the same games and trying to entrap them by sharing compromising material. It's highly embarrassing for the Conservative Party. It was trumpeting all day yesterday the fact that a recent index on soft power had put the UK at number two in terms of a global power, talking about its strength in defence, in security and intelligence. And when you've got a sort of senior MP in the governing party who has been caught up in something like this, it is highly embarrassing. Mm.
And the fact that two MPs immediately showed evidence of their own hard power by sending back explicit pictures of themselves.
No comment.
Let's talk about forcible blue ticks and Twitter. This is a really quite a funny story.
This is really funny. I mean, it just shows the absolute mess that Twitter is in. I mean, back in the day, let's call it a Twitter 1.0. Did you have a blue tick at all?
I did.
Yes, I did as well. And like, it wasn't something I ever asked for. It was just they had a policy of giving it to journalists in order to promote sort of accurate information and things like that. But what was interesting was, I don't know if you ever noticed this, sometimes if you were tweeting about something, particularly if it was something contentious and there were lots of people replying, there would be like anti-blue tickers who would be, you know, who would sort of come at you for having a blue tick and all this stuff. It was sort of seen as this like sign of privilege. And it was like, I didn't ask for this. It was just how the system works. Anyway, the whole mess of Twitter under Elon Musk, Twitter 2.0, means that you and I and Beyonce and everyone was stripped of their blue ticks. You had to pay to get some, you know, extra services to get the blue tick. And it means now that if you see the blue tick, more often than not, it's someone who is spreading disinformation, has not been vetted and verified, and it's an ecosystem that's in an absolute mess in terms of environment. Well, now Twitter has gone and it's anyone who has a certain number, I think it's 2,500 verified subscribers following them. So that's people who have seemingly now paid for their blue ticks, they will automatically get a blue tick for free. But lots of these people don't want it, because then it makes people think that they have paid to be blue ticked on Twitter. So another absolute win for Elon Musk this morning.
Absolutely. Vincent, thank you very much indeed. That's Vincent McAvaney. And now here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. In a call with Benjamin Netanyahu, US President Joe Biden threatened to condition support for Israel's offensive in Gaza on it taking concrete steps to protect aid workers and civilians. Biden's warning marked the first time he's threatened to potentially condition aid, a development that could change the dynamic of the nearly 6-month-old war. Support is building among African and Caribbean nations for the creation of an international tribunal on atrocities dating to the transatlantic trade of enslaved people, with the United States backing a UN panel at the heart of the effort. Though nobody directly involved in transatlantic slavery is alive, advocates say Western countries and institutions that continue to benefit from the wealth that slavery generated should be held accountable, particularly given ongoing legacies of racial discrimination. And torrential rains pummeled Australia's southeast today, dumping almost a month's worth of rainfall on Sydney and triggering flood warnings, with authorities urging people to avoid non-essential travel and stay indoors. Rains could intensify through Friday, with up to 200 millimetres expected in some regions before a coastal trough drifts east towards the Tasman Sea on Saturday. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. It's 8:31 in Brussels, 7:31 here in London. As we've been reporting, NATO has been celebrating 75 years since its founding by holding a two-day meeting in Brussels. The gathering was also to prepare for a leaders' summit in July. The alliance has agreed to initiate planning on long-term military support for Ukraine, but Secretary-General Jens Stoltenberg's plan to set up a 100 billion euro five-year fund proved contentious. Well, joining us from Berlin is Steve Erlinger, who is a who's the chief diplomatic correspondent for Europe for the New York Times. Steve, welcome back to the programme. Why is this funding plan, Stoltenberg's funding plan, important in terms of the coordination of arms, ammunition and equipment to Ukraine? How does it change the existing model?
Well, so far it hasn't. It's not real yet. I mean, it's a plan, it's a discussion, there's opposition. We'll see if it actually happens. What happens at the moment is the United States and the Pentagon coordinate allied aid to Ukraine through something that was informally known as the sort of Ramstein group, because it started at the Ramstein air base. And what NATO is trying to do is make itself a bit less dependent on the Americans for aid to Ukraine. So they're being pushed to give more money, but also the idea is that NATO would coordinate this aid instead of the United States. Washington can't see the point of that, and there are other NATO members who think it brings NATO too much into confrontation directly with Russia over Ukraine. So it's not a done deal. The 100 billion over a period of years, it's not that much money, to be honest. We're arguing in America about $60 billion tranche of aid. This would be $20 billion a year, and again, not a done deal. But the idea is, again, to make Europe a little more responsible for aiding Ukraine over the longer term, rather than going month to month or even year to year.
And I mean, of course, it does Trump-proof it.
Well, it doesn't, of course. I mean, because it's not enough money, and there's no guarantee Trump's going to win the election. And if Ukraine is trying to survive on $20 billion a year, I don't think it would keep them in nappies, let alone missiles.
So who is objecting to this plan, apart from America, and what are their exact reasons?
Well, the United States doesn't think it's necessary to change, but Hungary, Slovakia believe that NATO should continue to be a defensive alliance worrying about its own territory. They have no problem with countries of NATO, coalitions of the willing helping Ukraine bilaterally, even through NATO. But NATO so far provides only non-lethal stuff. So for these countries, it would be a step up in NATO's direct confrontation with Russia over Ukraine, and they think that's a bad idea.
And the Kremlin spokesperson, Dmitry Peskov, agrees. I mean, he does say that this relations with NATO have now slipped to the level of direct confrontation. What are the global implications of that?
I don't think there are global implications of that. I mean, Peskov is just talking, talking, talking. I mean, part of what Russia is trying to do is to intimidate everybody. I don't think it works very well. When Putin keeps bringing up nuclear weapons, it has an impact in a few countries like Germany. But I think you could just see this as completely rhetorical.
And have there been any discussions about putting NATO boots on the ground? Is there a scenario where personnel could be deployed to Ukraine?
Well, there are some special forces, but very few there now, from not from NATO itself, but from different countries that belong to NATO. Emmanuel Macron of France has had a sea change in his head. He really now believes that the Russian advances in Ukraine are a serious danger to Europe. A lot of people agree with him. He has always pushed for more European defense spending and more European responsibility for its own security. That's beginning to sink in, I think, to Western Europe. I mean, that's something the Poles and Central Europeans generally understood. But the idea of putting NATO troops on the ground, I think, is just a non-starter. I mean, I think he means it to send a message to Putin that the West is with Ukraine for the long haul. Mm. But NATO troops know. I mean, even soldiers from NATO countries, I think, would be a very difficult sell. The Americans are certainly not going to do it. And so right now it feels more like a motivational push than anything real.
Mm. And finally, Steve, what were the closing remarks from the two-day meeting? What has been achieved?
Well, the two-day meeting really is designed to prepare for the July summit in Washington, which is the official 75th anniversary summit. So these were discussions about ideas. What NATO wants to do is provide Ukraine in Washington with deliverables that are specific, that are longer term, that help them in their war against Russia. But NATO is not going to offer Ukraine membership negotiations. That's off the table. It was off the table last year in Vilnius. They don't want it discussed in Washington. They want Washington to concentrate on things NATO can do to help Ukraine now and in the next couple of years, not making vague promises for the future. There was also a lot of discussion about beefing up military supplies. The problem is Europe has pretty much exhausted what it has to give, but 90% of stocks are down. Factories are beginning, I think, quite late to sort of gear up. But until November, Ukraine is vulnerable, particularly on artillery shells and on air defense. So a lot of the discussion was about that. And a lot of the discussion was, again, among foreign ministers who are not the defense ministers, but how to prepare a successful summit in July that gives the Ukrainians a sense of hope, confidence for the future.
Steve, thank you very much indeed. That's Steve Erlanger, Chief Diplomatic Correspondent in Europe for The New York Times. And this is The Globalist on Monocle Radio. And now on today's show, it's Friday, which means it's time to hear Andrew Muller's unique take on what we've learned this week.
We learned this week that the US Justice Department has designated Catholics terrorists and commanded banks to hand over to the FBI the personal details of anybody who purchases a Bible. Second week running for the Dragnet theme. We too thought this all seemed like pretty startling stuff from an administration led by the United States' second Catholic president, but to disbelieve this news is to disbelieve Donald Trump Jr.,
Oh, no.
And whatever previous cause have we as a species ever had to do that, etc. We learned that the world's second worst Donald Trump had once again made one of those videos in which our lawyers tell us we can say that Junior comes across as noteworthily animated, energetic, spirited, and arguably even zestful.
If you were a practicing Catholic, you were a domestic terrorist. If you bought a Bible, you were marked by your banks, and that information was given to said FBI and DOJ. They think church-going patriots are terrorists.
Still, we learned of some good news there for the Trump family, at last and at least, as the crime of church-going patriot is one of few charges Donald Trump Sr. seems unlikely ever to face. Elsewhere. We learned that Adidas would appear to have a vacancy for a thinking things all the way through officer, or perhaps for someone merely capable of seeing things with their eyes. We learned that the German sportswear concern had, in designing Germany's shirts for the upcoming European Football Championships, favoured a sort of runic font for the numbers, which caused the 4 in particular to resemble a sort of stylized lightning bolt, and listeners with even the most elementary appreciation of the iconography of World War II may already be perceiving what Adidas did not.
Yikes!
Well, quite. We learned that undisclosed numbers of customers had, one earnestly hopes, earned themselves a place on the BND's watch list by ordering shirts emblazoned with a distinctly SS logo resembling 44 before Adidas announced that the number would be rendered unavailable, before throwing in the towel entirely and conceding that the 4 would have to be redesigned, hopefully not as some sort of cross-shaped assembly of right angles. Still, we learned that Germany might shortly have, literally, bigger problems. We learned that for the first time since Hannibal and his Carthaginian legions bore down upon Rome from over the Alps in 218 BC, Europe is threatened with invasion by elephants. Specifically, we learned that Botswana had threatened to deploy 20,000 elephants to Germany. We learned that this was a response to Germany's plans to restrict the import of hunting trophies and thereby discourage the besetting of elephants by rich weirdos labouring under the peculiar delusion that anybody might be impressed by their ability to hit a target that size. We learned, incidentally, when we looked into it, that these people are pretty much exactly who you'd expect.
Someone put pictures of me out there, like, you know, in Africa and stuff like that. And then they, oh, my God, you know, the media goes crazy. You know, I was apparently poaching elephant and, you know, high fenced elephant. You know, I'm like
Donald Trump Jr. again, who our lawyers tell us sounds no more than vigorous, buoyant, excited, perhaps vivacious at a push. Anyway, we learned that in the view of Botswana's president, Mokgweetsi Masisi, the Dumbo-hugging sentimentality indulged by clueless Europeans towards Johnny Elephant is all very well when you do not, as Botswana does, have to live with 130,000 of the immense creatures, each of which eats circa 150 kilograms of vegetation a day, and all of which lumber untowardly about, trample things, knock a lot of stuff over, and generally get in the way. And that, besides which the money parted from the fools who wish to blaze away at them, is a valuable source of revenue. President Masisi menaced Germany as follows, as will be read by Monocle's pachyderm desk chief, Emma Searle.
We want our elephants to roam freely. The German weather is bad enough for them. If you like them so much, then please accept this gift from us.
We learned, at least so far as we could be bothered to look, that Germany was choosing to maintain a diplomatic silence by way of response, which is a shame, as this retort was right there, as will be proposed by Monocle's German humour desk chief, Chris Chermak.
Perhaps if Botswana wants to discuss this, they can make a drunk call.
We did not as yet learn of, but hope to one day enjoy President Masisi making a similar offer/threat to the Prime Minister of Poland, as the Donald Tusk jokes will write themselves.
Ah! Oh! Ah! Ah! Ah!
Monocle Radio. I'm Andrew Muller.
I think the editor may have got a little carried away with the animal sounds there. Thank you very much, Andrew. This is The Globalist. It's time now to talk urbanism news with Urban Affairs commentator Kat Hannah, who joins me in the studio. Good morning to you, Kat.
Good morning.
If we've both now recovered from those extraordinary animals.
Just about.
We are looking at the housing crisis here in Britain. Housing associations have told the FT that they just can't build houses. What's the detail of that story?
So what this story is really looking at, and I guess just giving some context in, you know, the role of housing associations is primarily in terms of building homes for, you know, generally for social rent, so a discounted rent, but also in maintaining those homes as well, which is also critically important. If these bodies can't build, we've got a bit of a problem, because as we all know, we've got a very large shortfall in housing need. It's, you know, having numerous consequences, both economically, socially, obviously the human cost as well. And the article is essentially pointing out is that the financial model that we've currently got is not working. So the model by which you have some form of government grant, some form of public funding that is then kind of topped up by, and it's actually not really topped up because it's actually most of the money is then delivered by housing associations to build and maintain those homes, is just simply not enough to keep building. Because when you look at what's happened with interest rates, when you've also then had cuts to government funding, and as the article highlights, you've also had construction costs and other costs going up, you're trying to essentially keeping delivering the same amount of housing with what is effectively less money.
Yeah, absolutely. And as the article also points out, this is going to be a key election issue.
Absolutely. And, you know, the Labour Party came out earlier this week really being quite bullish, you know, again, on their stance about putting, you know, house building really at the centre of their manifesto, which I think is obviously going to be welcome from a huge amount of people. I think the question again will be, well, where is the money going to come from to do this? Because obviously everyone welcomes, I think, that commitment to house building. It's how it's going to be funded and delivered that will be really critical.
Whoever wins. Yeah. And this is questions that actually the chair of G15, which is a grouping of housing associations, is asking.
Absolutely. So there was a kind of a piece that was out same week as well in Housing Today, which is actually, you know, obviously focused very much on the housing sector, by Fiona Fletcher-Smith, who is, as you said, chair of the G15, which is the body of the largest housing associations in London. And then she's also chief executive of another very large housing association called L&Q. And it's quite a striking article because you can clearly sense actually just how frustrated she is, actually just how upset a lot of the sector are because they actually cannot deliver on their social purpose in terms of meeting these needs, supporting individuals, families, communities, but actually on how you can bring about this need for change and actually it really being about a change in mindset for the government into how we think about funding for housing.
Yeah, absolutely. Now onto a New York Times story about something that we used to call graffiti and say it was an eyesore to now something that's street art and makes neighbourhoods much more desirable. Tell us more.
Yeah, so this is a great piece by Isabella Quay, as you said, in the New York Times. And I chose this piece for a couple of reasons. Firstly, I live in Hackney Wick, which if anyone knows the area will know is pretty well known for its graffiti. So it kind of struck out from that reason. And actually, whilst this isn't a particularly new, you know, trend in terms of, you know, the role of street art in, you know, creating a sense of culture and identity in neighbourhoods, what I really liked about the article was that it brought in so many different international perspectives as well. And again, the role that both existing kind of street art is playing as communities evolve, but actually about street art essentially becoming a form of advertising and, you know, both developers, but actually businesses as well, commissioning graffiti artists for those purposes.
Mm. And as has happened in Hackney Wick, it does have the ability to completely change the character of an area.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's something that, you know, as you said, perception has very much changed about what that means. We are seeing a recognition, I think, by most developers that actually it's actually quite intrinsic to the character of an area. So the idea that you'd necessarily get rid of it is very different. What's probably quite interesting is we're not just seeing developers say, well, we don't want to get rid of it. They're actually saying, well, maybe where we haven't got it, we'd also like to get some of it as well. Because, you know, as one of the commentators in the article points out, it's a kind of way of bringing a bit of a cachet, a sense of buzz, a sense of creativity. And if you haven't got that, or maybe you've got an area that feels very new or a bit sterile, it can be one of those ways of creating a bit of a sense of creativity and identity.
But it's also talking about, this article questions whether it's good to kind of commodify this sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly, which I think is quite interesting, you know, the article raises, I guess, a couple of question marks, you know, around this evolution, which is, as you said, is the idea, for example, of, you know, graffiti artists being paid to do an advert for, you know, L'Oreal or some of these fashion, you know, campaigns that we see, is that a problem? Personally, I think it's very much up to the artist, whoever they'd like to do. And as the article points out, it's really important actually that artists get paid properly for this work, that they have the representation in order to be able to do that and to recognise their talent. But the other piece, you know, the other part of the piece is also around essentially the gentrification argument. You know, these areas that actually were often, you know, popular and taken over by artists almost, you know, before they were even on that developer radar. What then happens when some of those communities are priced out? And I think that, to me, is probably a much thornier issue than the idea of who should be paid what for painting where.
Absolutely. Let's finish with this Dutch competition, a national competition that has everybody ripping up their paving stones.
Yeah, again, I really enjoyed this article because it's slightly odd. There's also a degree of positivity about it. So this is a piece in The Guardian talking about tile whipping, which is essentially a bit of a competition that started in the Netherlands. I think it began actually during lockdown, for communities to see how many paving slabs they could remove from their gardens. And the idea of that is it's actually really about the environmental benefits you have from having grass rather than concrete. So again, if you think of a country like the Netherlands, huge amount of rain. If you have a load of concrete, that is going to create massive issues in terms of what happens in terms of drainage, as well as limiting biodiversity. So the idea is, rather than, you know, the council necessarily doing this, was saying, look, council will help you get rid of all of these things, but let's see who can do the most in terms of, you know, literally whipping off those tiles and creating space for greenery in your own front or back garden.
And to be clear, as they point out, it's not street pavements.
It does say, please do stick to your own gardens. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Kat Hannah, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Italian architect, artist and industrial designer Caetano Peschke has died in New York at the age of 84. He was a pioneer of the avant-garde Italian radical design movement that flared up in the late 1960s, and his work continues to be relevant with his exhibition Nice to See You on show at Milan's Design Week later this month. Well, I'm joined now by Ed Stocker, Monocle's Europe editor at large. Ed, good morning to you. Tell us about this colourful man's life.
I mean, he really was a colourful man. He'd lived all over the world. He'd lived in London, Paris, Helsinki. And since 1983, so for just over 40 years, he'd been based in New York City, working from Brooklyn's Navy Yard. And just, you know, extremely prolific. As you mentioned just then, his work spanned across so many things. He was an industrial designer, so he produced a lot of furniture pieces, and that's probably the thing for which he's best known. But he also got involved later in his life. He made some resin jewelry. He designed buildings, including one in Osaka called the Organic Building, that was a sort of pioneer for vertical gardening, vertical greenery, something we see all over the place nowadays. And he was also an artist. As you mentioned in that little intro, he sort of rose up In the late 1960s and 1970s, he was part of this Italian radical design movement. And that sort of threw the rule book out the window. It was critical of modernism, although it did embrace some aspects of it. But he was very much against uniformity. He liked there to be imperfections. He was a great experimenter and user of colour, and part of this sort of movement was also experimenting with new materials. So he used plastic, he used resin, and he created these amazing curvaceous shapes and quite often really wacky colours that went against the more sort of minimalist and safe modernist design options that were around at the time as well.
What are some of his most memorable pieces?
Well, the sort of piece or pieces that everyone is talking about now and for which he's undoubtedly best remembered would be the Up chair. It was actually a series of chairs that was produced by B&B Italia, then called B&C Italia. And this had a very particular, again, curvaceous shape, inspired by the form of the female body. And what was interesting, sort of, a lot has been attached to this chair. A lot of, and Pesce wasn't one to shy away from being political, or making statements. But this was sort of, this has sort of been dubbed at times as a feminist chair. You know, and he said some things about it in the past. He said women suffer because of the prejudice of men. And one interpretation of the chair, anyway, is that the ottoman is sort of a ball and is the ball of a ball of chain to sort of say how women are sort of enslaved at times by the patriarchy, by men. So that's one thing he did. But he was so prolific, just so much, really. He did a Green Street chair for Vitra that was almost like spider-like and had eight legs. So many fascinating things, really, throughout his career.
And his most recent collaborations?
I mean, that's the thing. He was still so prolific later in his career. For example, back in 2022, so just a couple of years ago, he did a collaboration with the Aspen Art Museum in the US. This was, you know, inside the museum was a sort of all sorts of different works from the artist. But the amazing thing was he did an installation covering the whole facade of the building called My Dear Mountains. It was the sun setting over mountains. So that was a pretty impressive, huge scale work. And he actually used that as inspiration for a bag he went on to make for Bottega Veneta, the Italian fashion brand. He did a number of collaborations with them towards the end of his life, including producing a whole set of chairs for a fashion show and also doing this immersive installation, which is where the bag featured for its flagship store here in Milan.
And of course, his show will be on display in Milan during Design Week, as I said. Monocle's also going to have a presence there.
It is, yeah. Nice to see you, which is about 30 works from the last couple of years of his life will be on display at Biblioteca Ambrosiana. And you are right. We have a huge presence. We always do, Georgina. We sort of come on down to Milan. We send a team over from London. We're going to be at the Pinacoteca di Brera, beautiful building. On the 15th, 16th and 17th of April, we're going to have a three-day series of talks from around 10 a.m. in the morning with Fortzug, and so that will be a great one for people to come and digest. And also, we, you know, we have a radio presence as well, don't forget that. We're going to be at the House of Switzerland in Brera, where we'll be broadcasting and interviewing a whole load of designers along the way.
Ed, thank you very much indeed. That's Ed Stocker. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Laura Kramer, Tom Webb and Monica Lillis, our researcher, George Ruskin, and our studio manager, Tamsin Howard. After the headlines, there's more music on the way, and I'll be back with The Briefing, which is live at midday in London. And The Globalist will return at the same time on Monday. I'll also be with you tomorrow for the weekend edition. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.